Today, 50 years on, how the Stonewall Rebellion changed the world for the LGBT community. And, in opinion, Lucy Siegel on how to wean yourself off ultra-cheap clothes and fast fashion. I just want to start with a warning. There is a tiny bit of swearing in this episode.
This is now...
Okay, so you just ignore that.
So I'm sitting with Tommy Lanigan Schmidt, who's a New York artist. We're sitting in his very small and incredibly cramped art studio, surrounded by powder paints and glistening kind of foils, which is the kind of art that he does.
You know the picture I'm in, right? You never saw the picture? Oh, yeah, I should show you the picture, because the picture is a kind of like a very important.
We're looking together at this photograph, a black and white grainy image of a group of young people standing under the Stonewall Inn sign in Greenwich Village in New York, June 1969. And there, on the right-hand side of the photograph, is this young guy. He's wearing a stripy T-shirt and a little gold chain around his neck, curly hair, looking really kind of excited and smiling at the camera. And that is Tommy, age 21. He's surrounded by all his mates. They've come out of the Stonewall Inn. They've been in the rebellion itself. And suddenly they have this photograph taken. And it's like, you have to kind of step back a tiny bit to know what an astonishing image that is. Because for gay people in June 1969, to appear together in the street, even of Greenwich Village, which was the most famous, most populated gay neighborhood in the world, even for them to do that, before the rebellion, they would have been immediately arrested, thrown into police cars and held overnight. Here they are celebrating each other on the street of New York. It's kind of a revolutionary moment captured in this one image.
That image could only have been captured after an uprising outside an iconic New York gay bar exactly 50 years ago this week. It was a night that changed the world. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the Stonewall Rebellion, remembered by the people who were there.
Well, I don't think you can understand the Stonewall Rebellion and its significance unless you understand what life was like the day before. I mean, so if the rebellion broke out at 1:20 in the morning on June the 28th, 1969, you got to know what life was like on June the 27th, 1969.
Ed Pilkington is chief reporter for Guardian US.
Like anyone, I knew that there had been discrimination against the LGBT community. I had no idea of how blanket it was, how uniform it was, and how total it was. I came across this image of something that happened 1 week before the Stonewall Rebellion in a local park in Queens in a neighborhood called Kew Gardens, a fairly leafy, middle-class area. Local residents had discovered, or there'd been rumored, that gay men were coming together at night when the park was entirely empty and were using it as a meeting place under this lover lane of trees. So the local residents started to gather and they started to form vigilante groups, and sometimes those groups were as large as 40 people strong. And they started to prowl through the park looking for the gay men. And when they found any gay man, they would beam a very powerful torchlight that they were carrying into the face of the gay men and tell them, unless they got out of the park immediately and never came back, they would be attacked. There was something in the air because the gay men refused to do that. They refused to leave. So you can already see the sort of first seeds of resistance, of saying, no, we're not going to do this anymore, not going to be coward anymore and told what to do anymore. The vigilante groups went away, they went home, they scurried around their toolkits, they brought back saws and axes, and they chopped down all the trees in the park. The police sat outside the park in a car and they watched. And for me, that was just the most extraordinary image of the kind of blanket discrimination that they had to put up with. It was all against them.
I mean, was this kind of homophobic attitude institutionalized?
Totally. I mean, let's not forget, it still is. Federally, there is still no law against discrimination for gay people in housing or employment. But at that time, it was entirely institutionalized, to the extent that there was only one state, Illinois, in which it was legal to do sexual acts relating to homosexual activity. And it went further than that. In seven states, you could be legally castrated if you were having consensual sex in your home.
Just being gay then was being a criminal. I mean, a liberal would say you should be given shock treatments. They thought that was nice, because a conservative would say you should be thrown in jail. So that's,
and this is like New York. It's kind of, you have to pinch yourself. It's meant to be the bastion of liberal politics in, you know, in America, if not the world. But even the sort of liberal friends, quote unquote, of someone like Tommy, they thought they were being nice to him by saying to him that he was mentally ill and he needed treatment, including electroshock treatment.
This involved showing the gay man pictures of nude males and shocking him with a strong electric current. Over a short period of time, he will be unable to get sexually aroused to the pictures. And hopefully, he will be unable to get sexually aroused outside in other settings as well.
And that was not a joke, and it was not a sort of light threat. Because until 1973, the main National Society for Psychiatrists in America, in their official list of mental conditions, deemed homosexuality as a mental illness.
Before we start, just say for the benefit of my machine here, tell me who you are, how old you are, and a little bit about your relationship to Stonewall.
My name is Jim Forratt. I'm 77 years old, and you're in the apartment that I lived in 1969, which is a couple of very short blocks away from Christopher Street and the Stonewall. I got fired from three different jobs because I was gay. I remember working at Eastern Airlines as a reservations clerk, and one day they came to me and said, "Are you homosexual?" And I said, "Yes." Fired, and I had no recourse on that, you know, and it wasn't that I had done anything. I wasn't blowing someone in the men's room. I wasn't coming on to some superior. Just the idea that my behavior indicated to them that I was homosexual. You could not be out. You led dual lives.
You met loads of people reporting on this. Jim Forratt, Tommy, many others. Did they tell you they were physically threatened?
Absolutely. I mean, like you, when I came to interview these people, I started with questions like that.
Then, did you ever face violence yourself?
Oh, lots of times. That's just something you...
And they kind of gave me looks, because it's like, hello?
There's even a street term for that. If someone got beat up, they show up with like a black eye or like lumps on their face or something. People would joke about it, say, oh, you got your gay knocks. That's what that was called. Once in a while, someone would end up in the emergency room or dead. There were always people ending up dead, being fished out of the Hudson River, like with their eyes all eaten by whatever is down there.
To step out into the street as a gay person or as a lesbian person or a trans person was to be physically threatened.
So it was an incredibly difficult time to be gay. Where were people able to be open about their sexuality?
A culture did start to begin of gay bars as places where you could meet in relative, and I use that word advisedly, relative safety. Virtually every gay bar, I think in fact every single gay bar, including lesbian bars in 1969, were actively run by the mafia. They would open a bar, some people think they would then pay off the police, and the police would periodically raid the bar because that would allow them to think that they're keeping control, whereas actually the mafia were running these places. They would serve diluted liquor. Some people think they would blackmail the more middle class married gay men who came to the bar and use that as a way to get an extra income stream. So there was quite a lot of pain and hurt in these places, but still, at a time when there was nowhere else, they were frequented by people, and it allowed them to some degree find a way to feel like real people like whole individuals there in these hidden places. Of all of them, the biggest in New York, and therefore probably the world, was the Stonewall Inn.
Everyone went there. There was no glass in those windows. It had black plywood nailed up, and it didn't have lights on the outside because it was a mafia place. No one that wouldn't know it was there would know it was there. So there was some like power-hungry, like lower-level mafia guy, and it was usually like early 20s, that opened the little door, and then he decided whether you're gonna let you in. You go in, and it had no decorations. It was all black plywood inside, and it always kind of smelled like a kind of like sexy sweat smell and beer, like floating through the air. And then you go into the other room. And that room was the better room. That was called the black room. Just had better music and better dancing. And this was a different from the other dance bars because this place would let you dance slow. And that's a very, very, very important thing. So it was very different than meeting someone on the street, because meeting someone on the street, you could get killed. You didn't know what they were about. Meeting someone in the Stonewall, there was a little time to figure them out because you could dance with them. And then dancing with them slow, you hold on to them. So then you have a kind of affection that like all the straight kids just have by grace of life. When you dance with each other, you're given a kind of solidarity of personhood. I can't find smaller words to say that. You feel good as a person. It was like a huge burden was lifted off you. It just felt, it was cozy in there for us. When they try to remove it, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. I mean, what if they're gonna take that away? That's like taking our personhood away.
Let's talk about that night. The 28th of June, 1969. Like with any major turning point in history, some of the details are hazy and disputed. But as far as we can tell, what happened?
As the Greenwich Village became an increasingly famous gay area, you had both a feeling of greater strength among gay individuals, but you also had greater oppression, and they collided with each other. From about 1964 onwards, the police started stepping up their raids. The guy who led most of them, Seymour Pine, was the head of the vice squad in the NYPD. It was a Saturday, the 28th of June. Seymour Pine led a team of seven police officers, some undercover, some in uniform. And he kind of frog marched them into the Stonewall Inn. And I think it was a sign of how confident he felt that they went in like a sort of marching army. He was determined, and we know from what he's said since, he was determined to, quote unquote, do the job properly, because he was sick of raiding all these bars and then the next day the mafia would reopen them. So he decided to go in and he would tear up the long bar in the first main room of the Stonewall, and he would chop it up into little pieces, which for me was a kind of chilling echo of the chopping down of those trees in Queens that we'd seen just 1 week before. And almost immediately, things started going wrong. Seymour Pine died in 2010, but he left behind, before he died, lots of recordings of his reflections of the night.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting. One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
She gets out, she's like throwing her bulky body against this police car that begins to tip. Now, it did not tip over, but there is a moment, a spontaneous moment that I will never forget, where something happened. It just hit me that this was our moment.
Crowds were building up quickly there. The people that wouldn't usually like make a scene were making a scene too once it started. It was like it ignited pretty quick. It wasn't like a slow simmer or anything. It was something that like you just got carried on the waves, like if you're at like the ocean and the beach and the wave picks you up and go ooh, 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 ooh. Yeah. The only place we can go is being like insulted by being like closed down by like these like police that are like indifferent or hostile to us as human beings. And so we didn't even think, we just fought. It was like fighting back for your home.
People started throwing things. They started throwing coins at the police. They started jeering at the police. And they started becoming assertive. There was a sort of wave of assertion and even to some degree aggression that came from the crowd. It was now a crowd. It wasn't a milling gathering. It was a crowd of people. And at that point, Seymour Pine actually had to shut the doors and barricade himself and his men and women. There were some women police among them inside the Stonewall just to protect themselves.
I know I was frightened. And I've been in combat situations. And there was never any time that I felt more scared than I felt that night. I mean, there was just, there was no place to run.
This same guy had been a major figure in World War II and had written a manual for hand-to-hand combat for U.S. Army troops. He's terrified. A hugely significant moment.
Does that mean that outside it was getting violent?
One of the big points of debate is, like, how violent was it? David Carter, the author of the most authoritative book of Stonewall, his book is called Stonewall, The Riots That Sparked the Gay Revolution. I spoke to him at length, and he says now if he had another chance to go around, he would call it The Rebellion That Sparked the Gay Revolution. And I asked him why, and he just thought riot gave the wrong connotation. It suggested a sort of indiscriminate sort of violence. And he preferred rebellion because this was more an expression of gay uprising, of gay assertion. And I think that's probably right. There was a sense of joyousness, I think, which you have to take on board to get a real sense of what Stonewall meant. It wasn't just a sort of face-to-face confrontation. There was a sense of, we are going to taunt you with our gay culture. So they had the kick lines. People would run round the back of Greenwich Village through the small little streets that run through the area, and they suddenly reappear at the back of the police lines, and then they would taunt them again and sing songs at them.
We are the village girls. We wear our hair in curls. We wear our dungarees rolled up above our knees. We wear our sweaters tight. We give the guys a fright. And then tra-la-la, boom-dee-ay, tra-la-la.
It was fucking fun. There was an exhilaration of this, without really realizing what we were doing, being able to look at other gay men in not a sexual context, not in a mafia bar, not in a subway toilet, not in a bathhouse, being able to see people sort of integrated as people having, feeling good about themselves in the street with other people, not afraid. See, this is the critical thing, not afraid to be visible. The release of fear, the celebration of personhood in that moment, to feel that you were not fucked up.
At the time, in real time, they had a very strong sense that something extraordinary had happened. Now, they didn't know exactly what it meant. They didn't know what it would become 50 years later. But they knew in the moment that their lives had changed. And everyone I spoke to said that in a most powerful way.
The descriptions I've read suggest the police were humiliated that night. They never expected this group of people to rebel. The streets weren't cleared until after 4 a.m. and then it happened again and again for 6 nights overall, getting lots of coverage in the media. What were the consequences in the immediate aftermath and the years that then followed?
Wow, there's so many. I mean, for me, people walking down the street holding hands was one of them. People being able to form groups in the street and without fear of arrest was another one. The most important in terms of longer term change was the chanting of the phrase gay power. And that had never really been heard from heard of before in public. But it started on the first night. One person in particular said it. Second night, many more people started saying it. It started to be chanted through the crowd. Gay power, gay power. And from there, it started to crystallize and cement into groups coming together, discussing how to organize and how to manifest this new sensibility into marches, into political organizations, into political change. There had been gay groups. The groups that formed after Stonewall were not the first, but those that came before were tiny. They were very kind of well-mannered, to put it that way. They talked about integrating. They talked about, if we're good and nice, please give us a few rights. There was that kind of tone to it, I think. Post-Stonewall, immediately, within days, it was people standing up and saying, no, we've had enough. We are angry. We're not putting up with this anymore. About a week after the rebellion had ended, people got together and they started discussing whether they could have a peace march, which would be, let's put forward some positive images to sort of show, you know, that we're all part of society and that we're happy to integrate in this society. And Jim Forat, he stood up and he said,
no, we are not going to be nice. We're sick and fucking tired of this treatment. I mean, something to that effect. It was about being fully dimensioned as a lesbian or a gay man. And just the fucking right to be different, whether you're straight looking or you're old or you're rich or you're poor or you're trans or whatever, the right to be different and have equal rights.
In terms of the 50 years that followed, you know, we can't possibly go into the detail of what is, after all, an extraordinary, massive narrative arc of things getting better. I mean, you think of the very first gay pride marches that happened, again, within weeks of Stonewall. They kind of happened organically. People started marching. Then you think through the way that the gay community rallied around HIV and AIDS and demanded treatment from the medical profession. And then you think forward through the extraordinary revolution of gay marriage in this country. And now we're seeing Pete Buttigieg, the first openly gay presidential candidate in America, and he's doing incredibly well. So it's been an extraordinary narrative, and Stonewall was at the very beginning of all of this.
You've spoken to people who were there at the time, who've watched the world change over 50 years, who've seen great strides towards equality, but also, recently, the election of a US president and vice president who say really worrying things about LGBT rights and a rise in homophobic attacks both in the US and other countries, including here in the UK. For them, is this 50-year anniversary a celebration of progress or a reminder not to take anything for granted?
Well, you have to say both. I was very struck by all the people I interviewed for this Stonewall project, that they had a sense of apprehension, a kind of fear about the present day, a kind of almost a sense that the walls might be closing in on them again.
I'm an old man now, and I might get married this year, but I certainly wasn't about wanting to get married in 1969, okay? And I do have a new relationship, and old men can have relationships, and it's really hot, and I just want to put that in. I walk down the street with my boyfriend, Joel. He's 74, I'm 77, and sometimes I say, watch it, because there's a group of men coming towards us. I have been beaten up. I know what these things are. Am I afraid to be gay? No, I'm not, not at all. But I'm realistic, you know, I'm realistic. And I think that the heightened kind of rhetoric that is based on anger and hate and manipulated in fear, fear of the other. You know, I watch the young people. They seem oblivious in the way that I was oblivious to fear, you know. But I think it's a very dangerous time we live in.
No one I spoke to was being complacent about the dark times that we seem to be entering. And being the kind of guys they are, they're very, very firm about a need to resist it because that's where they came from. But if we ended on that note, I think it would give the false impression, because overwhelmingly this 50th anniversary is a celebration. It's a remembering of this extraordinary moment where people found themselves for the very first time and found their own internal and external power.
It is unimaginable to me, in 1969, what we have achieved. My generation of gay and lesbian people risked everything. They built a movement, and I feel that what we did has changed the world. I take great pride in that.
That was Ed Pilkington. You can read his brilliant report on 50 years since Stonewall at theguardian.com. Coming up, £1 bikinis and £5 dresses. A culture of disposable, ultra-cheap fashion might be convenient, but who really pays the true costs? Now, earlier this year, a report from a cross-party group of MPs into the fashion industry in the UK made several recommendations for improving sustainability and conditions for garment workers. Last week, all the MPs' points were flatly rejected by the government. One of the people who gave evidence to their inquiry was columnist Lucy Siegel. She argues that even if the government won't act, there are still things consumers can do.
There'd been a government inquiry into plastics, single-use coffee cups, pollution in rivers. But then when it was announced that the Environmental Audit Committee was going to look at fashion, and not just fashion, they actually singled out fast fashion. I couldn't really believe it. So I was asked to go and give evidence. And so you sit there on a panel and you have a sort of buzzer and a microphone. It's a bit like being on University Challenge or something. I think the sense that we got was that they were very shocked by what was going on. And they were shocked in particular by a couple of things. They seemed to be shocked by the waste being generated by the fashion industry. According to statistics from DEFRA and from RAP, the Waste Resources Action Programme, the UK every year, we will throw away 300,000 tonnes of textile waste, most of which will be fashion and most of which will be fast fashion. There are some reports that suggest that we wear pieces of clothing an average of 7 times. Well, that is crazy. The second thing that was really shocking for them was investigations into production of fashion manufacture in Leicester in the Midlands, where they found people being paid well below the minimum wage. So those were the two elements which I think gripped them most. And the other thing is, just to give it more context, we are more and more aware of the emissions caused by the fashion industry. We know, according to UN modelling, that by 2050, unless we get a radical approach to fashion, the fashion industry as a sector will be responsible for a quarter of all emissions. Extinction Rebellion say that in the UK, our emissions from fashion are higher than for aviation and shipping combined. Absolutely gobsmacking. This is an industry that absolutely needs regulating. The Environmental Audit Committee produced a report called Fixing Fashion, which contained 18 different recommendations for the fashion industry. The government reported back, and it took up 0 of the 18 recommendations. So none of them the government intends to take forward. And that included one of the main recommendations, which had a lot of traction within the industry itself, which was for a 1p levy per garment that would fund some sort of waste collection and processing. My response was that I was really shocked, actually. But there's so many things that we can do. We mustn't feel like it's game over. It's not. If you want to be really, really out there, stop buying fast fashion. Isn't that a thing? Wow, how would we get dressed in the morning? So if you extend the lifespan of each garment for 9 months, you reduce its impact, including carbon emissions, by 20 to 30%. I have long instituted the 30 wears rule, hashtag 30 wears. So that brings me on to another thing that you can do. Delete fashion apps on your phone. If you do shop online, and I prefer not to for clothes, don't get lured into that return thing when you're ordering, you know, 4 sizes or 4 colorways and then sending 3 back, because we don't know what happens to those clothes. And there is some evidence to suggest that those are making the waste more prolific. You can take the impact out of laundry by not washing too often. You really want to make fiber an important part of the way that you shop. So cotton is a luxury, okay? What you want to do is get some other interesting fibers in there. What about a little hemp blend? Lyocell, modal, that's from tree bark. I think when all's said and done, I really, really think that what was in the Fixing Fashion report is so important that we shouldn't just let it go. Yes, we can do things ourselves, but we had those recommendations and we need legislation. So please, 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 if you just do one thing, write to your MP and tell them that you want the recommendations in the Fixing Fashion report to be implemented.
That was Lucy Siegel, and you can find more of her writing on ethical living at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Ed Pilkington, Tommy Lanigan-Schmidt, Jim Ferrat, and Lucy Siegel. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Lucy Greenwell. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.